Bembenak claimed that the department was comprised of
Welcome back. Caitlin and I were having a blinking competition. You know how you have a...
communicating in blink code.
A staring competition? We're doing the exact opposite.
Blinking too much.
Welcome to Eat Crime.
A podcast full of delicious mysteries.
you sounded very aggressive with that.
Gotta fix my mic. Sorry for all this. I'm adjusting my microphone if there's a lot of background noise, so sorry.
Hi, I'm Amy.
I'm Caitlin.
And welcome back to Eat Crime.
We've been doing this for hours now.
Sorry, we're a little aggressive today.
Just I've had too much shirt.
These cops that kill really get me fired up.
Ooh.
Really get me. They really salt my sugar.
It's a really topical discussion.
These really salt my sugar.
But we're not talking about any cops of recent nature.
Yeah, this is, actually, yeah, now that you say that, this doesn't bode well. But it is topical.
I feel like we probably should have written different stories, but
that you know, didn't. This is a really good story. I mean, it's a very interesting story, I think, and in light of recent events, well, we're just not going to talk about them.
Yep.
Let's. This was last aired back in October, 2019. We'll just take a step back in time to a simpler. It was a simpler time.
It was a much simpler time.
2020 really did a number on us.
You and I were fresh out of school and...
with the whole future ahead of us.
Oh, gosh. And now look at it. Mm. It's just crumbling.
That's bleak. All right. This is a terrible beginning of this episode. Hopefully you haven't been like, these people are too dismal for me.
Well, if this is the first episode you're listening to, it's, I guess you're working backwards, but.
You never know. People might be like, oh, cops who kill. Let me watch that.
They're probably hoping for a different story.
These are not good people in general, regardless of the fact that they're cops.
So I'm going to tell a story.
I think they would have, these people probably would have figured out a way to kill whether they were cops or not.
And it doesn't help that they were given a weapon.
Nope.
All right. You ready?
Yep.
Lorenzia Ann Bambi Bembenak.
No, this lady.
Also known as Lori Bembenak.
Bembenak. Bambi Bembenak.
Born on August 15th, 1958 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Where did the name Bambi come from?
I don't know, but I like that her nickname is Bambi, but she didn't use it. She went by Lori. Yeah. I guess maybe because her last name is Bembenak.
I guess, but... she's like, heck no. Call me Lori, please.
She was the youngest of three girls. Her dad, Joseph, worked as a police officer for Milwaukee Police Department, but quit after what he said was corruption within the department. Would you look at that?
Hey, that's a thing.
Smart guy. She was raised as a Roman Catholic. She went to Bryant and Stratton College and received her associate's degree in fashion merchandising management.
Wow. So, like,
nothing that has to do with the law.
Right.
After college, she worked in retail and worked for a short time as a model and was even Miss March in a 1978 calendar for the Joseph Schmitz Brewing Company.
That's obscure.
A very niche modeling job. Yes. She started training for the Milwaukee Police Academy in 1980, but a tip came through that she was seen smoking pot at a party. She denied it, although they did investigate her. Nothing came of that investigation. Bambi Bembenak speculated that it was the wife of another police officer who confronted her at the party because the woman thought Bembenak was leading her husband on. I'm not... like, leading her husband on makes it seem like she, like the wife was okay with a relationship, but not with the fact that she was, you know... pretending to flirt with her husband and then no relationship was coming from it.
What? This is confusing.
It's not like you would go to a woman and be like, are you trying to seduce my husband? She was like, are you leading him on?
What's happening?
Are you making him fall in love with you only to break his heart?
Yeah. I love my husband. I don't want some floozy to break his heart.
You can make him fall in love with you. That's fine. But just don't lead him on.
Gosh. Have some decency.
She graduated in 1980 and was assigned to the Southside 2nd District in Milwaukee. Bembenak claimed that the department was comprised of, quote, brutal, lazy, apathetic, and corrupt, unquote, people, that females and minorities were subjected to abuse and harassment during training, as well as harsher punishments for minor infractions, while white male officers went unpunished for more serious things. Hmm. How topical.
Interesting.
On August 25th, 1980, Bembenak was dismissed from the police department for her involvement in a false report filed against her friend and fellow officer, Judy Zess, after Zess was arrested for smoking pot at a concert. They're really, really cracking down on the pot. After she was fired, she discovered photos of other police officers dancing nude and semi-nude at a party.
What?
Yeah. She took them to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and said, hey, like, I got fired for lying when my friend was arrested for pot, and these guys are nude at this party, and they're still working. Why? They encouraged her to file a report with the Internal Affairs Department, and then the article that I was researching from never said anything else about that, so I don't actually know what came of that.
Okay.
Since she couldn't go back to being a police officer, she went to work as a waitress at the Playboy Club in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Well, that doesn't really bode well for your image.
I know.
You're trying to fight sexism. That doesn't really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Around this time, she met her future husband, Alfred O. Fred Schultz.
Alfred Fred?
Alfred, with an E.
Oh, Alfred Fred.
Fred is his nickname.
Oh, okay. I thought that was his middle name. I was like, what?
His middle name is just O.
Oh. Okay.
It probably stands for something, but I don't know what.
Ollivander.
Oh, that's nice. He had been working for the police department for 13 years and had two sons. He divorced his wife, Christine, in November of 1980 and married Bembenak in January of 1981.
That's quick.
Yep. She and her husband lived with Zess and her boyfriend in an apartment while Bembenak worked as a personal trainer. She's really trying all these careers out.
She's going to try everything.
She later changed jobs again and became a campus security officer at Marquette University. In November of 1981, Bembenak and Schultz had to remarry because a judge declared that their marriage was invalid after Schultz failed to wait the 6 months post-divorce to remarry, which is the Wisconsin law. Some places it's like a year.
Yeah.
I guess because they want you to be sure, but I feel like if you've decided...
Maybe they want you to try to give your marriage a shot.
I feel like if you've gotten to the point of divorce, you've probably tried everything.
Maybe you haven't.
Maybe. May 28th, 1981, 6 months after Christine and Fred were divorced, Christine Schultz was found lying face down in a pool of blood in her home by her two sons, who were then 7 and 11.
Oh, gosh.
She had been gagged, blindfolded, and her hands were tied in front of her. One shot from a .38 caliber revolver was fired into her back at point-blank range, going through her heart. The 11-year-old boy, Sean, described the person who shot his mom as a, quote, masked male figure in a green army jacket and black shoes, unquote.
So they saw it happen?
Apparently.
Oh my gosh.
Or not maybe saw it happen, but saw the person.
Yeah.
He also said that the man had a long reddish ponytail. At first, Fred said that he was investigating a burglary? That's a hard word to say. Burglary. With his partner, Michael Durfrey. But years later, he changed his statement and said that the two were drinking at a bar.
Years later?
Yeah. Fred also had been...
Does he have a long reddish ponytail?
I don't know what Fred looks like. Hmm. Fred also has been exonerated from the murder of Officer George Robert Sasson in July of 1975 in Glendale, Wisconsin. Sasson was off duty when he arrested someone at a bar. Schultz and another officer responded to the call and mistook Sasson for the suspect. When he turned around with a gun, Sasson was shot to death. Glendale was outside Schultz's jurisdiction, and he was cleared by the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office.
But why are you coming in guns a-blazing?
Why are you shooting a man who's not coming towards you?
Right.
Why are you shooting anyone? Police started suspecting Lori after ballistics revealed that the bullet that killed Christine came from Fred's off-duty revolver, which she had access to, along with a key to Christine's house that Fred had secretly copied from his son's key.
So why are we not suspecting Fred.
Well, we were suspecting Fred, but, you know, he had that alibi.
About drinking?
Quote-unquote alibi.
Okay.
Well, his first alibi was that he was investigating some other case with his friend there. At the time, Bembenak had blonde hair, not red, and was 5'10". And from pictures, she looks pretty thin. Like, sort of...
Not really mannish.
Yeah. I mean, she was 5'10", but she was in, like, slim fit shape.
Well, depending on what you're wearing.
Yeah. Nonetheless, she was arrested for the murder on June 21st, 1981. So her trial was very public. The media started calling her Bambi. That's where we get the name from. And the prosecution painted her as this loose woman with financial trouble who wanted to kill Christine in order for her husband to stop paying alimony. Two hairs were found on the scene that matched ones taken from Bembenak's hairbrush. They also had the gun, which belonged to Frank. Frank? Isn't his name Brett? Why did I write... Yeah, his name is Fred. That's weird. They also had the gun, which belonged to Fred. And the fact that Bembenak had access to the gun and Christine's house kind of made her look a little guilty.
Yeah.
Sean, the oldest of the Schultz boys, said it was not Bembenak that he saw at their house that night. Witnesses for the prosecution stated that they heard Bembenak talking about killing Christine, and one witness even said he received an offer from Bembenak to kill Christine in exchange for money.
And she was pretty young, right?
Yeah.
Bembenak, she was like 23 years old.
Not sure how old she was.
This is the thing that I looked up. Said that she was.
Oh, okay. Prosecutors also pointed out that Bembenak owned a blue bandana and a clothesline like those used to bind and gag Schultz. There was also a wig found in the plumbing system of Bembenak's apartment that allegedly matched hairs found at the crime scene. This was a shared plumbing system that connected to their neighbors. When questioned, the neighbor said that Zess asked to use her bathroom, and after she left, her plumbing was clogged. How suspicious.
That is suspicious.
Zess also admitted to owning a wig matching the color description. An employee at a boutique confirmed that Bembenak bought a wig shortly before the crime. And on March 9th, 1982, Bembenak was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison at Taycheeda Correctional Institution.
You know what's easier than buying a wig? Putting your hair up in a ponytail and putting a hat on.
Oh, not murdering someone was going to be my answer.
Oh, that as well.
So after the trial, Fred believed that Bembenak was innocent, but later came out and said that she was, quote, guilty as sin, unquote.
Yeah.
Bembenak believed Fred hired someone to kill Christine and let her take the fall, claiming the attorney that was hired by Schultz failed to tell the jury that there was evidence against Fred. June 28, 1983, Bembenak filed for divorce after receiving a letter from Schultz saying that he had moved to Florida and was living with a 19-year-old woman, and they had decided to end their marriage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They being...
him and his new lover?
I guess. Or maybe it was just a him decision. The divorce request was granted on June 19, 1984. Bembenak filed three appeals, one for mishandling evidence, one about Judy Zess taking back her statement for the prosecution stating it was under duress, and one about how they singled her out for her involvement in the investigation in police corruption, all of which were unsuccessful. People in support of Bembenak believed it was a man named Frederick Horenberger who committed the crime for Schultz. Horenberger was the former boyfriend of Judy Zess, and he had been in trouble before. He had even robbed and beat Zess prior to Schultz's death. While in jail for assaulting Zess, other inmates claimed he had talked about killing Schultz, but Horenberger denied his involvement until his suicide in 1991. There was also discrepancy with the hair analysis. Dr. Samuels, who did the autopsy, claimed that the hairs found at the scene were the victim's, but the hair analysis, Dr. Hansen, said that they came from Bembenak's hairbrush. Bembenak earned her bachelor's degree while in prison, founded a prison newspaper, and became engaged to Dominic Guglietti, which was her cellmate's brother.
Did you know that she escaped prison?
That's literally my next line. On July 15th, 1990, she escaped through a laundry room window and was picked up by her fiancé. They were spotted 2 days later in Wisconsin, and then Guglietti's truck was found abandoned at a Target. The two fled to Canada, and media picked up her story again, which sparked a movement of people wearing Run Bambi Run shirts. And a song was even written about her. I don't know what that song was. I tried to find it, and I could not.
This poor lady, she's like, I don't even like the name Bambi, okay? And I am getting so much attention.
Call me Lori, please. She started going by Jennifer Gazzana and worked as a waitress and a fitness instructor. So I guess I guess out of all the careers she had, she would like to settle on waitress fitness. And fitness instructor.
Which were kind of the first ones.
Yeah.
Well, not really.
October 17th, 1990, the couple was captured and arrested by a bystander. Nope. After a bystander recognized Bimbenak from America's Most Wanted. Guglietti was deported and sentenced to a year in prison. Bimbenak sought refugee status in Canada, claiming that she was being persecuted by a conspiracy between the police department and the judicial system in Wisconsin. That was a quote from her as well. I forgot to say a quote. Canada did feel a little sorry for her and
the entirety of Canada.
And before deporting her, they had the Wisconsin court agree to a judicial review of her case. So they didn't feel bad enough to keep her in the country.
Right.
Evidence found no crimes committed by the police or persecutors, but did identify 7 mistakes that were made during the murder investigation that granted her a new trial. She voluntarily returned to the United States in April 1991 and pleaded no contest to second-degree murder in 1992. She was sentenced to 20 years, which was reduced to just time served. She was released 3 hours after the hearing, after having served a little over 10 years.
She didn't get in trouble for running away?
Apparently not.
Okay.
Is that a crime?
To run away from prison?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Running away from prison.
You've been charged with running away from prison.
Yeah, you get like time added onto your sentence for trying to escape or escaping.
Well, I knew that.
Well, then that's what that is.
But do they have like a name for it?
I don't know.
Okay.
Unlawfully running. Unlawful running. So come look at this picture of Bambi. So this was her. She's actually a very pretty lady.
She is a pretty lady.
Yeah. So this is her, you know, in the newspaper, right?
Look at her all dreamy with her.
Like, she says, no, that's a pen. Oh. She has this look a lot.
Yeah.
Like,
it's very, like, regal. Very Bambi-esque.
Very regal. That's not her. And then this is her and it appeals.
She looks bored, but... Oh, look at that mullet!
She has got a full-on mullet. Like, this is short in the front, super short, and then all
that
down her back.
Quite the party in the back.
It is all down her back.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And then she's back to this.
Quite far from the Farrah Fawcett that she once was.
Yeah.
Oh, and
that's
look
her.
At her.
That's her now.
Yeah.
Very well, that's her in, like, 1992 or something.
Right.
So... her life after prison is just as crazy, if you can imagine.
I can imagine.
She wrote a book and developed a bunch of health problems, including hepatitis C, PTSD, and alcohol addiction.
Mm.
She moved to Washington State in 1996 and met a man named Marty Carson, whom she later married. Marty?
Oh, Marty. Okay.
He built her a studio so she could paint as a form of therapy. And then she put her paintings in a gallery, but the gallery burned down, and she lost all of her paintings. In 2002, she had her leg amputated below the knee after falling, or possibly jumping, from a second-story window and breaking her leg. She said it was the people from the Dr. Phil show that caused her to injure her leg after they allegedly kept her confined in an apartment. She continued to say that she was innocent, but the court wouldn't allow the overturn of her no-contest plea. She filed an appeal with the Supreme Court to have the conviction reversed. Her attorney mentioned that there was evidence not brought to court, like the male DNA found at the scene and proof that the victim had been sexually assaulted. Her appeal was denied in 2008. She inspired some movies and some shows and some books.
I think the movie is called Run, Bambi, Run.
That's a possibility. And she passed away on November 20th, 2010, in hospice care from liver and kidney failure. And she was only 52.
Wow.
In May of 2019, Bimbenak's attorney, Mary Warrior, Warrer sent the Wisconsin governor a pardon request to clear her name posthumously. Posthumously. I always say that word wrong. So I don't have an update yet on whether or not they were going to do that.
Oh, wow. I mean, she really only was a cop for a very short period of time.
Right.
Still a cop, though. Still fits in with the...
Still a cop.
Yeah. So we're thinking that she didn't kill.
Right. Or do we think she killed?
I'm wondering if it was Judy. I don't know what Judy looked like, but the whole wig down the toilet thing kind of weirds me out. Mm-hmm. Especially because it matched the color.
Right.
Or maybe Judy knows who did it. Maybe it was Judy's aggressive boyfriend. Former boyfriend.
Who was
boyfriend.
Judy again?
Judy was also once a cop. And she got fired for smoking pot at a party.
That's right. And she was the one that went to, like, the employment thing. And was like, hey, why are these people?
No, I think that was... Bambi who did that. She was like, my friend got fired for smoking pot and all these men are naked at a party. So, I mean, that's a big reason why I chose the story is because, like, Lori tried to, really point out these injustices just like her dad did and be like, there's a whole lot going on here that is not fair.
Yeah.
And... that may be one of the reasons why she was considered guilty if she was innocent, you know?
Yeah. I'm kind of tending to lean towards the fact that she might be innocent.
I am too, but I really think that, Zess has something to do with it.
Well, it said that, the thing that I just very briefly read said that they did... DNA testing on the 15 items that was taken from the crime scene, mm-hmm. and her DNA wasn't found on any of them.
Yeah, and there was, like, male DNA on them.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
Please. So.
All right, well, let's have a snack.
Okay.
Let's have a little snacky snack.
I would just like to tell you that escaping from prison is being charged with felony escape, so.
I was right. Kind of.
Hey, true crime fanatics. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Brittany.
And if you're looking for a new true crime podcast to feed your cravings, check out The Abyss Pod.
We scour the web to find the most intriguing cases to share with you every other Monday. You can listen on Spotify, Stitcher, Google and Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and any other streaming app.
Follow us at The Abyss Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, or check out our website at theabysspod.com.
Dive into the true crime abyss with us.
This is our last episode of the retro relaunch throwback episodes.
We can't land on anything to save our lives.
We can't. Our Halloween specials last year were called Spooktoberfest.
Spooktacular Spooktober Festival of Saints.
It was like Spooktoberfest Spectacular or something like that because Amy and I could not agree on a name. She always thinks my ideas are way too simple, and I don't understand what's wrong with simple. She wants to make it so dramatic.
Yeah.
What were they called? Let's see. They were called Crimetoberfest Spooktacular.
There it is.
I just wanted to call it the Oktoberfest Spooktacular, but no, Amy had to add in Crimetoberfest, which is not a pun on October at all. But that's Amy for you.
That's me.
Always extra to the extent.
To the extent of what?
Being extra. Oh, you are as extra,
extra
as
to
extra.
To the extent of being extra.
Yeah, as extra can be.
All right, let's eat something.
All right, so we got a lot of snacks to get through today.
Okay, let's do it.
We got to finish them up. Reaching into our magic bag, what will we find?
What will we find? I'm going to record you.
Oh, I already pulled it out.
Okay.
It's here, I'll reveal it to you.
Okay.
In video form. I'm coming up on the top.
Oh. I'm ready. Oh, I see our little friend.
It's a push pop.
He's a push pop. Yum.
I think there's two in here.
Yeah, there is.
Which one do you want? You want the strawberry or the...
I'll try mystery.
The mystery sour flavor?
I'll try it.
Ooh, that sounds good.
All right.
Ow. Oh, are you okay?
It's back to you. Oh. It wants me.
Jeez, Amy. You have two hands.
Only one can reach over there.
Push Pops. Did Push Pops have a theme song?
Push the pop and flavor comes out.
Oh, I don't like that. I was a big fan of the large Push Pops with the tri flavors.
That stressed me out. Too much. Too many things.
All right, here's a Push Pop commercial from 1991.
Okay, let's hear it.
What's happening with your Push Pop there?
Come here.
What? There's always been wrapping around it.
I know, but I can't. Here, can you hold that? I can't get it off. Oh. 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 I don't like this at all. I'm going to be eating plastic. Is that... Oh.
This is why I didn't think you were going to pick the sour one. You always act like you don't like sour things.
I want to... I've been eating so many strawberry things.
That's true.
All right, is there any more plastic on here? How would anybody know? All right.
Well, if you don't taste flavor, then...
Here's the Push Pop. Ooh, I almost dropped it.
Do you eat your Push Pops like that?
I'm going to push the Push Pop back down.
Ridiculous.
I think it's green apple.
It looks like green apple. Is it super sour?
Mm-mm. It's a little sour. It's fine. I don't understand how you push it, though.
From the bottom. You put your finger...
It's just a hole. Oh, there it is.
Yeah. Put your finger in the hole. What was your favorite Push Pop flavor as a kid?
I have no idea.
I have always been a mixed berry kid. Blue raspberry, mixed berry.
I remember the blue raspberry. I loved orange things as a kid.
These also remind me of the pool. They taste kind of like ring pops.
Mm-hmm.
Strawberry is very good.
What's up next? Those Push Pops are pretty good.
That's a good flavor. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm going to throw it at you.
You're going to throw it at
me? It's coming at you.
All right, I'm ready.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
That was a bad throw.
It's Fun Dip.
It's Fun Dip. We're just cruising right down memory lane here.
Memory lane. I actually really like Fun Dip.
I used to eat these and Big League Chew at the baseball diamond because my brothers played baseball, and being the last child, I was taken to all of the
strung
games.
Along.
This was suggested by the Drunk Dish podcast, so thank you for that. Thank you to everyone who sent in suggestions.
Yeah.
We got some really good ones. Some of them I could not find. Like, there was some bubble gum that Ghosts of the Stratosphere.
What?
that's their name.
Oh, I thought it was some bubble gum that went to the stratosphere.
Oh, no. Ghosts of the Stratosphere is the person who suggested this. Suggested these, like, bubble gum cartons.
Curtains?
Cartons. Like milk cartons.
Uh-huh.
Could not find those. The Demi World podcast suggested chocolate zingers. I did find those on Amazon. They're like Hostess cakes. Sort of like a long cupcake. Hostess cupcake. I did find chocolate zingers on Amazon, but they were like $20 for
they must be like super
one or
rare.
Two. Well, I don't think they make them very much anymore.
Ooh, so they're probably old.
Cinema Flavor suggested white cherry Gatorade, which I don't know where to get. And also microwave cheese curds, which I do love cheese curds. But not from my childhood.
I love a Fun Dip.
The Banshees and the Booze, they suggested bagel bites, which Amy and I just talked about. Love a bagel bite.
Mm-hmm.
Love a bagel bite.
Why don't we get bagel bites?
Because they require cooking.
Oh.
This person's name is Sequels That Should Have Been Made Podcast. It's a very long podcast name. But your picture is very dapper. Suggested the beef jerky that came shredded up like chewing tobacco. I don't know.
I remember bubblegum like that.
I don't know where to get that. That's Big League Chew.
Yeah.
They suggested that. So thank you, everybody, for... suggesting things. Oh, and What Should We Watch? Our friends over at What Should We Watch suggested the Stauffer's lightly glazed animal cookies.
Oh, I did not like those.
I liked the circus ones, the fully frosted sprinkle ones. And I liked the plain ones, too.
I do like animal crackers.
And then Alex from 3 hours later suggested Nesquik, which is another difficult thing to get on the podcast.
You know.
Have you ever had Nesquik?
I don't think so. I used to have Ovaltine.
Ooh, I was an Ovaltine kid, too.
Yeah.
I love Ovaltine. I just recently tried Nesquik.
Was it good?
It was okay. Not quite Ovaltine, but...
I didn't like Yoo-Hoo.
I took Yoo-Hoo, the juice boxes, to school. Because my mom was fancy.
I like the stick a lot, too. It's just sweet.
Yeah, it is nice. It's probably just compacted sugar, but... Are you making too many noises over there? You're really getting into it.
I'm just really enjoying this fun dip.
So much of my editing is cutting out just chewing, licking, crunching. Don't do it on purpose. What I love about Fun Dip is that it changes colors.
It does.
Is this a revelation?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, it's called Raz Apple Magic Dip.
It's magic.
What did you think was magic
about
it?
It's really pretty.
Mm-hmm. It's like a... It starts off as like a really pretty sea blue, then it turns into like a nice grassy green.
I love it.
I used to always have a problem of eating the stick before I finished the dust stuff.
Because the stick is good.
It is.
Okay.
The kids who gave these out on Valentine's Day were like the MVPs.
Yeah, the best ones.
Okay.
That was right good.
Well, it's very good.
All right, well, you're still fun dipping.
No, we're not done. We have one more snack.
Oh, my goodness. I just want to talk about crime.
I know. I'm sorry, but we have to do it for the people.
Do it for the
last one.
Oh, we have had so much fruity candy.
I know. I feel like we have really compacted the 90s into one food category, and that is
fruity candy.
Fruity, very sweet candy. These were suggested to us by the History Cash podcast. I hope that's how you say it. Or is it cache? C-A-C-H-E?
I think that's cache.
The History Cache podcast. I obviously should listen more to figure out how to be smarter. These are gushers.
Gushers.
I was not allowed to have gushers as a child.
Why?
I think they were just too sugary. My mom focused on cakes instead of, like, fruit snacks. We were, like, a oatmeal cream pie. Ho-ho cake kind of family.
Meh.
Oh, we did have fruit by the foot every once in a while, or like a fruit roll-up.
Oh, I love fruit by the foot.
I do too. The red and blue ones, amazing. But I got the gushers because I'm an adult now and I can make my own food decisions.
Right. Well, I tell you what. I'm ready.
Oh, yes. Perfect catch.
So... I'm going to play the Gushers commercial from 1994.
Hold on, let me get my package open.
They were a little scary. I have
most 90s commercials were. Wow, this is hard to get open. Okay.
Sprinkle, sprinkle, no, not sprinkle, sprinkles. What in the world? I don't want sprinkle, sprinkles.
Do you remember the yogurt that used to come with sprinkles?
Very
the Dannon Sprinkle-Ins. Did you ever have those? Yogurt.
That
they
sounds
were,
familiar.
They were yogurt cups that came with sprinkles, and you would, like, mix them in, and I think they would change color or something. Oh, they were great.
All right. I'm going to have an orange one. Are you ready for my head to turn into an orange?
I got a blue one.
Okay, you ready?
Here she goes. Turn it into an orange. Boing! Getting rounder by the second.
Yep. True about my head and my body.
So many jokes about your body on this podcast. The blue ones are kind of gross.
We actually have two boxes of these in my cabinet at home.
Would you like another one?
Nope.
Because I probably won't eat any of these.
Oh, I do not like the green one. And I have three green ones.
I mean, the texture is really rubbery.
Yeah.
And they just, I mean, I don't even know what flavor they're supposed to be, but they don't taste like any fruit I've ever had. I am interested in the concept of a gusher, though.
Just, it's just fruit. Fruit covered. Jelly covered fruit juice.
But it's like gel. It's not quite juice.
Yeah. It's liquid.
The green ones are red inside.
I don't like that at all. It's not bad.
So many of these snacks were disappointing.
I know. I wouldn't seek out, you know?
No.
Any of these, I don't think.
That's why I tried to pawn them off on you.
The cheese sticks, I would seek those out.
Just regular cheese sticks?
No, the cheese
dip. Oh, the cheese dippers we had earlier.
Our first episode. Would definitely seek those out. Those are delicious.
Available at Target.
I'm more of a savory than sweet person.
Yes, I know you are.
So, I would have really liked bagel bites. And I know you would have too.
I would have guessed, but they require lots of cooking.
Well, not lots of cooking. You just put them in the oven. She's back to the push pop, so that must mean it's good.
I just wanted to get the gusher taste out of my mouth.
Oh, yeah, right.
All right. I mean, so, would you like to go get some bagel bites after this?
No, it's fine. You're like, do I need to provide you with bagel bites?
You look so sad. No. I'm so sorry I chose the wrong snack.
It's okay. It's quite all right.
Look, I did heavily consider bagel bites. Because I love them.
Yeah.
But, like I said, they require cooking, and we are very far away from the kitchen at this moment.
It's a whole floor up.
And I don't want to be responsible for my house catching on fire.
You know what, Caitlin, it's fine. Let's just drop it.
So sorry.
Let's just drop it.
I'll get you bagel bites.
No, it's okay. All right. So
Amy's like never disappointed because she hates disappointing people by being disappointed. So when her face looks sad, I get really nervous. And I feel like I need to like buy her a new puppy or something.
Oh, I'd love a new puppy.
And Josh would not.
Yes, he would. He's like, we need a puppy for Stella.
Really?
He's like, Stella, you want a little brother? Want a little sister? Like,
don't want a human one?
You
want
human or puppy version?
Yeah, right.
So Jenny Webb was a 32-year-old living in Buena Vista, Michigan. These, both of our stories take place in the
Midwest.
Midwest?
I think Wisconsin's considered the Midwest.
Michigan? Midwest?
Question mark? Are you from Michigan?
I don't know.
I don't know anyone from Michigan.
She was 8.5 months pregnant with her son, Braxton James. Very pregnant.
Correct.
Yes, that's very pregnant. She was really excited about the pregnancy, but had been kind of vague about who the father was. Like, close friends and family knew his first name and what his job was, but had never met him. Jenny had said that the father was someone she had known for a really long time. They were friends for a long time, but he was married, and that was why she was kind of secretive about it. Jenny's friends and family stated that she was prepared to have this baby alone and basically be a single mom, and she was fine with that. Her friends said that she had no illusions that the father would enter into a serious relationship with her or leave his wife for her. So, on August 31st, 2011, Jenny is at her friend's house helping out with her friend's newborn twin girls. She says that she has to leave to go meet with the baby's father to discuss the parenting situation, custody agreements, names on birth certificate, child support, that kind of stuff. As she leaves, her friend tells her, she tells her friend that she will see her at the same time tomorrow to help with the girls. Around midnight that night, officers Ken Blue and Tim Patterson pull up to an idled car on the side of the road near an officer shooting range. The front doors open, and as they circle around the car, they find a woman's body with an extension cord around her neck, with the other end tied to the roof rack. The woman is pronounced dead by the officers, and they start to look through her stuff to look for identification while they're waiting for detectives to show up. Are you okay, Caitlin?
Yeah.
You had a very sour face.
I'm trying to get something out of my tooth.
I, like, look over your... Oh, goodness.
I'm focused on you, though.
Oh, thank you. Officer Blue looks through the woman's purse and finds a folded up piece of paper that he unfolds and identifies as a suicide note. It says things like, the baby's father is some random guy I met at a bar, it was a one-night stand, I don't want to disgrace my family, and I didn't want them to think that I was a whore.
Oh.
I can't support myself, let alone a baby, and it ends by saying, this is the only way, I'm sorry, Jenny. The officers look into her wallet for an ID and find out that it's Jenny Webb. At this point, Officer Blue was like, oh man, I know this girl. I've seen her at this local bar I go to. This is so sad. Oh dear. Oh dear.
I am sad.
Detective Sean Waterman arrives on the scene and takes a look around and determines it to be a cut and dry suicide. Which, okay. He says that there's nothing that would suggest otherwise. There's a note. He does make a note that it's unusual for a woman to hang herself, but he said that he's seen it happen, and it's obviously very possible.
And she's hanging from, like, a car roof rack?
She's sitting upright on the ground.
So she's not hanging.
She's not really hanging.
She's on the ground.
She's sitting upright.
So she definitely didn't choke herself to death, unless she was, like, running at full speed and broke her neck.
For a long time. And, like, the other side is on the roof rack, which is, you know...
I'm taller than my car.
Right, well, I'm not. But, you know, it's just not practical. Like, who would do that? That's so weird.
And so public.
Yeah, and why at the car? Like, there's probably... I mean, I don't want to be, you know, crass or whatever and unsensitive, but there's trees around. Why would you choose a car roof rack, you know?
It just doesn't... add up.
It doesn't.
It sounds like if it was a suicide, it sounds like a really rushed decision. But she would have had to have what all the stuff, like an extension cord or something?
Right. And I mean, but apparently Detective Waterman is like, this looks totally normal.
Of course.
I'm a great detective.
I checked the bed.
Right.
It's me and Amy's number one rule when you're looking for a missing person, always check the bed.
That's right. Officer Patterson goes up to the detective and says that he came out here because Officer Blue hadn't been answering any phone calls or radio calls, and Officer Patterson had come looking for him. When they found him, they came upon the scene. Officer Blue had gone radio silent from about 9:05 to 10:30. That's over an hour.
That doesn't look very good for you.
Almost an hour and a half. Why would you do that? Patterson decided to go looking for him on this, black secluded road back...
Black secluded road?
Patterson decided to go looking for him on this back secluded road because that's where Blue was known to go to when he wanted to sleep on the job. So I guess he was like, he's like, oh, that Officer Blue always sleeping on the job on the back road.
That's a terrible practice.
Right? So Blue states that he and Officer Patterson pulled up at about the same time. They went around to look at the body. Blue noticed her chest wasn't rising or falling and that her lips were blue. For that reason, he didn't check her vitals to see if she was still alive.
Okay.
Of course, he saw enough of her to decide she was dead, but not enough to realize that he knew her and saw her one to two times a month at the bar.
So, and also, like, was she still going to the bar while she was pregnant? By herself?
Who knows? I have no idea. So the detectives, they notify the family and they bring the suicide note. He goes to Jenny's mom's house and tells her there's been a suicide and that Jenny is dead. Jenny's mom responds, she may be dead, but she didn't commit suicide.
You go, mom.
That's right. He shows her the typed suicide note. And Jenny's mom is so convinced that she wouldn't commit suicide, she doesn't even want to read the whole thing. She's just like, starts reading it and she's like, nope, no. This isn't real. Nope. Over the next few days, as friends and family hear about it, the general consensus is that there is no way that Jenny would have killed herself. She was too excited about the baby and their future together. So as Detective Waterman is conducting the investigation, the question of who's the father of the baby is raised, if not for any other reason than for notification that his son is dead, along with the mother. So I can't really pinpoint how they figured out that Officer Blue is the father of the baby, but they did.
Well, I would assume that they did an autopsy on her, right?
Yeah, and
they probably did a fetal autopsy.
Right, but how would they know it was Officer Blue?
Well, they could take DNA and...
Yeah, well, I read somewhere that Jenny's father mentioned it to the detectives. Maybe he knew or had seen him or something.
Maybe.
Either way, an investigation is launched into Officer Blue since he was the first one at the scene, and now there's this allegation that he's the father of the baby and definitely knows her pretty well. Since a police department can't investigate one of their own, the Michigan State Police get involved and take over the investigation. While the Michigan State Police are looking over the crime scene, even though the car has been moved, they find a pair of flip-flops in the ditch, and then a couple hundred yards from the scene, they find a necklace charm, a cigarette butt, and a splatter of blood. They also take Jenny's car and Officer Blue's car in for lab testing. As detectives search through Jenny's phone, they find Officer Blue's number saved as Ken Cop Boo. And
nice.
And find that they made 3 calls to each other that night that Jenny died, and again had made arrangements to meet up to discuss custody, etc. After Blue shows up to the crime scene that the state police are investigating in civilian clothes, he's told to leave the scene and wait at the police station for an interview. During the interview, Blue goes over his version of what happened. He stated that he realized he knew her and expected that he would be investigated. There are cuts along his forearm in the shape of and pattern of fingernails, a cut to his forehead, an injury to his right eye, and a band-aid on his index finger.
Little you'll suspicious.
Look, you'll look a little rough, Ken.
What were you doing? Martyring?
He time and time again denies having slept with her and was completely against the idea that the baby could be his. Because, of course, they never slept together. Now, alright, cop.
Alright, Ken Cop Boo. Alright, Ken.
You are an officer of the law. Did you forget DNA evidence exists?
Do you forget how any sort of investigation works? Like, right. Do you think that you're just too smooth or above the law for them to figure out? Like, you think that people are just going to look at you and be like, oh, no, Ken would never do something like that.
And they're
he's a cop. He's right. A good guy.
And they're just going to be like, okay. So, obviously, they're like, well, we need DNA to confirm this. And he's like, okay, yeah, we did sleep together.
I guess I'll let you in on that little secret.
Yeah, but the baby's not mine. No way. Okay. So now the crime scene has his DNA to match against the items found at the crime scene, because he gave his DNA. In Jenny's clothes, the tip of a latex glove is flat. I can't talk either.
We're having trouble.
In Jenny's clothes, the tip of a latex glove is found with blood on the inside and saliva on the outside. The blood on the inside is determined to be Blue's, and the saliva is Jenny's. She bit his finger.
Right? Yeah.
Ken Blue bleeds all over Jenny's clothes.
Blue bleeds.
Blue bleeds all over Jenny's clothes, the extension cord, Jenny's car, his own patrol car, and his uniform.
Real Ken's, smooth. This.
This guy. Ken's uniform is requested to be given as evidence, which he happily hands over, but the clothes that he hands over are completely clean and folded and pressed. Obviously not the ones from the night of the crime.
Oh, you want my uniform? Yeah, sure. Let me just go get it out of my closet for you.
Yeah. So they search Blue's personal truck and find a stash of clothes hidden underneath the seat with his blood splattered all over them. And guess what else they find in Jenny's car? Officer Ken Blue's bloody fingerprint. The one that was missing the glove.
What a dumb man. Not even just a dumb cop, a dumb man.
And the fingerprint had a chunk missing.
I wonder what's hiding under that band-aid on Ken's index finger.
Right. The fingerprints they took at the station also had a chunk missing.
That's weird because they don't know each other.
Exactly. They've never slept together.
He just sees her at the bar.
This is weird. The autopsy comes back on Jenny, several bruises and cuts all over her body, and the ligature marks found from the extension cord were post-mortem. Mm. Her cause of death was determined to be asphyxiation by chokehold. A police manual... This is not crazy. This is just...
It's the best part.
This is the best. A police manual open to how to chokehold was open in Blue's front patrol car seat.
Just the fact that the police manual includes how to chokehold makes me upset.
A little nervous. Well, I mean, look, in some situations, maybe. But you don't have to have the manual open when you're sleeping on a back road to that particular
flashback hold. To Scott Peterson, who left his phone book open to defense attorneys.
Right. So, and the cherry on top was the identical extension cords were found in Blue's house.
Of course.
So, 14 fingerprints were found on the suicide note. All of them were Officer Blue's, and none of them were Jenny's.
That's so weird. I mean, she obviously typed it and then went to the bar, had him print it, then he was in on it.
And folded it and put it in her purse. The index finger that had a chunk missing was not found on the suicide note, showing that he had premeditated the murder, planned the note, and had been carrying the note around with him. Right?
Right.
Officer Correct. Ken Blue is, obviously, Officer Ken Blue is arrested and charged with the murder of Jenny Webb and her son Braxton. Ken's sister is still insisting that he has to be innocent, says maybe Jenny was just trying to be dramatic and was trying to scare Ken, but ended up dying, and that all the blood was planted.
No, ma'am.
It runs in the family.
Stupidity, you mean?
Yes. The jury only needed hours to decide that he was guilty. He was arrested with life without parole for Jenny's murder and a 65 to 100-year sentence for Braxton. So he's going away forever, where he needs to be. Terrible guy.
Awful.
Terrible. I mean, I think this is probably the story that started the whole PSA, don't murder.
Oh, yeah.
But, like...
I think it was.
Don't... You are so dumb. Like, you shouldn't even be an officer if you're that. Like, you would be the type of officer that's like, oh, there's 100 fingerprints of this guy at this scene. He probably didn't do it. He said he didn't do it. He's like, I'm an officer. I can get away with whatever I want.
No, you can't, sir.
No. Some police officers, you know.
All right. We're going to end this quickly because I'm on 1%.
Oh, my. Okay.
All right. So you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at Eat Crime. You can also email us at podcastc, as in cereal, k as in killers, @gmail.com. No dot, just podcastck @gmail.com. And you can also find us on Facebook at Eat Crime Pod. Thank you so much for listening to these redone episodes. We hope you've enjoyed them.
Retro throwbacks.
Please check out the charities in the description. Some of them have to do with police brutality.
Thank you again.
We'll see you next time.
Thanks. Bye. Oh, nice.